From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Republicans and Democrats are gearing up for Judge Samuel Alito's confirmation hearings. The confirmation process as we know it is relatively new. There was a time when nominees didn't even appear at their own hearings. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at the history of the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominees. We talk with David Yeloff, author of the book Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. Also, rock historian Ed Ward considers the role of Sandy Denny in the British folk rock revolution of the 60s. She sang with the band Fairport Convention. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Republicans and Democrats and special interest groups on each side are gearing up for Judge Samuel Alito's confirmation hearings. Have confirmation hearings always been as politically charged and divisive as they are now? To put the Alito confirmation hearings in context, we invited David Yelov. He's the author of the 1999 book Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Justices. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. The confirmation process, as we know it, is relatively new. How recent is it, and what was it like in its earliest times?
Well, there were closed hearings on Supreme Court nominees in the late 19th century. We don't know a lot about what happened in those hearings. Obviously, they were closed. We do know that sometimes nominees were rejected. But to be honest with you, the nominees themselves didn't even show up to those hearings. We didn't even have a nominee show up and testify until, you basically have to get into the early 20th century when you see nominees showing up. Interest groups and their involvement, which is so regularly understood today as a fact of life, that didn't really kick in until later in the 20th century. So what the hearings that we see for Supreme Court nominees today are really starkly different concepts than hearings for Supreme Court nominations were even 50 years ago.
Why weren't the nominees at their own confirmation hearings? Is it you had the choice, you could go if you wanted to, or was it just understood they talk about you, but you don't have to show up?
I think that it was understood really on both sides. Well, why would we need the nominee here? Some nominees even specifically said, I wouldn't want to go because I wouldn't want to be put on trial. And that was classically put to the test when Louis Brandeis himself, quite a controversial nominee, decided when he was nominated in 1916 by President Woodrow Wilson, he said, I'm not showing up. Not only am I not showing up, he refused to even comment to newspapers or media at all about his nomination. Such a marked contrast to the way we deal with nominations today.
And what was his reasons for not even commenting to the press?
Well, quite honestly, very few nominees before him had commented on the press, so he could rely on tradition. The types of nominees that would even comment to Senate Judiciary Committee members, that itself was unusual, were really nominees who anticipated that they might be in trouble. And some of them might have lobbied individual members of the Senate Judiciary Committee or even written a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the theory that I better say something in my defense or I'll be in trouble. So I think that lots of nominees would take the position, as Brandeis did, I'm not going to lobby on my behalf because that would imply that I need to be defensive. And most of them didn't even do that. We really didn't get the classic image of a Supreme Court nominee going to the Capitol, taking the oath and testifying until 1925 when Harlan Fiske Stone was nominated to the court and really felt he needed to air some issues regarding some incidents when he was an attorney general. And he aired them and was confirmed. But even then, it didn't become a regular process till the 1950s.
How have the nature of the questions changed, the questions that the members of the Judiciary Committee ask the Supreme Court nominees?
Well, it's obviously difficult for us to tell because they were all closed hearings before early in the 20th century, and so we don't know exactly. There's a famous quote from Abraham Lincoln who was asked about his own nominees to the court, and he very famously said, you can ask them anything they want, but if they answer you, we should despise them. And I think that was the kind of approach that that questioning took. You could ask them things, but they probably wouldn't respond. Certainly, they wouldn't respond if in any way gave any indication of how they might one day rule. You really have to move it further into the 20th century, really into the 1950s, 60s, and especially in 1970s, when these hearings became the opportunity for senators to very specifically ask, what do you think of this issue? How might you rule? What is your judging philosophy? I mean, those kinds of pointed questions are really part of the confirmation process only in the past half century.
You say one of the questions likely to be asked is how would you rule on a certain issue? But I thought that's the one subject that senators feel like they can't really ask. They'll try to find out the answer, but not by directly asking it.
senators don't necessarily concede at all that they can't ask that. Many senators believe they not only can ask it, but that they have an obligation to ask it because they're not sure what this nominee might do and that there are very important issues and constitutional disputes at stake. So many senators take the firm position that they're obligated to ask those questions. I think the more controversial question is, what if the nominee doesn't provide clear, unambiguous, and direct answers to the questions? Could that become a basis for rejecting the nominee? I think that is what's a little more at stake and a little more controversial. But you will find, really going back even to the 1950s, when William Brennan went before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and especially Abe Fortas in 1965, some very pointed questions, criticisms about what they'd done before and what they might do again.
What kind of questions?
Well, Abe Fortas, it's a pretty famous example from 1968. He had already been on the Supreme Court for 3 years, and he was now being promoted by Lyndon Johnson to be Chief Justice. And really, his confirmation hearings marked a change because it really became an instance for a referendum on the Warren Court as a whole. The previous 8 years or 6 years or so, the Warren Court had had a clear majority and had advanced and extended defendants' rights and free speech rights and various other rights much farther than the court ever had in its history. And you had, by the time you hit 1968, some very frustrated senators angry about the Warren Court, especially some of the Southerners and many of the more conservative members. And I think they saw Abe Fortas's hearings as an opportunity to really criticize the Warren Court and put Abe Fortas on trial and the Warren Court on trial. And of course, that's quite ironic because Abe Fortas hadn't even been on the court for the entirety of the Warren Court. So very pointed questions about his opinions on some of the more controversial cases. Gideon versus Wainwright was a case he'd actually argued, not sat on the court. Miranda versus Arizona, those types of cases. Defendants' rights and the rights of the accused were very much in play in 1968.
And the outcome of his hearings was controversial, too.
Yeah, well, he never got the vote on the merits. We hear a lot today, every nominee deserves a vote on the merits. Harriet Myers very recently did not get a vote on the merits. Her name was withdrawn, and actually Abe Fortas didn't get a vote on the merits either. There were some procedural votes, and it became very clear that the votes were there to filibuster his nomination, if that's what it came to. And ultimately, he and Lyndon Johnson together made the decision that his name should be withdrawn from consideration. So that kind of putting the Warren Court on trial was effective. It should be said, however, Terry, that Abe Fortas was nominated in Lyndon Johnson's final months in office. He was at that point a very defeated president, and it's very hard for a president to get a nominee through when they are beginning to see the end of their own term in office.
Now the withdrawal of the Fortas nomination remains controversial because some people consider that a filibuster, since he was withdrawn, because had he not been withdrawn, there would have been a filibuster and he would have been defeated. So some people count that as a filibuster, and other people say, no, there never really was a filibuster, so you can't count that as a filibuster. And that's controversial now because of the issue about whether Democrats should have the right to filibuster if they don't like the president's nominee.
No, you're absolutely right, and there actually are two sides to this debate. I don't think anybody who actually looks at the congressional record and sees that there were cloture votes taken could possibly come to any conclusion other than the fact that Abe Fortas was, and his nomination was, frankly, filibustered. I think, though, Senate Republicans today make the argument, and this is perhaps true, that while Abe Fortas was filibustered, there were not even 51 votes in the Senate to confirm him. And so their argument would be that the Abe Fortas precedent doesn't represent a filibuster precedent as it does today, because the filibuster is being used by Senate Democrats today, at least it has with lower court nominees, to stop nominees from getting votes when there are 51 votes in favor of their confirmation. And so that's, I think, the distinction between Abe Fortas and today that Senate Republicans try to make. And I think Senate Democrats respond, a filibuster is a filibuster. So there really are two sides to that issue. And the truth is, Terry, we don't know whether Abe Fortas would have gotten 51 votes on the floor, just as we don't know if Harriet Myers would have, because ultimately only if you take the vote can you know.
Well, the question of filibusters leads to the question of what is the role of the Senate. It says in the Constitution that the role of the Senate when it comes to judicial nominees is to give advice and consent to the president. And so, you know, interpretations of those words are very far-ranging. What are some of the ways they've been interpreted historically?
Well, I think earlier on in our country's history, if you go back to presidents like Jefferson and Madison, they really made very, very determined attempts to involve the Senate and individual senators in particular in advising them on nominations. And I think that was particularly true, Terry, because there was a sense that there needed to be a geographic diversity on the court. All of the various Supreme Court justices during this early period would, quote unquote, ride circuit. They would have to actually go out to a circuit where they were the responsible justice and actually serve on the courts of appeals there. They were the, quote unquote, circuit justice. And so from that standpoint, geographic diversity was considered important because you would want a southern justice to represent the southern circuit. And as a result, Thomas Jefferson, just as an example, would talk to senators and even House members from the South when he was choosing a Supreme Court nominee. And that kind of geographic diversity was considered important. It should be said that no president felt obligated to talk to senators, and some did and some didn't. But really, even if you move up into the 20th century, some senators, particularly the more well-known and revered senators, would have a very specific influence. Very famously, Theodore Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes to the court, in part because the Massachusetts senator, Henry Cabot Lodge, recommended and endorsed him. And actually, Theodore Roosevelt regretted that nomination very soon afterwards when Oliver Wendell Holmes didn't provide him the votes he wanted on antitrust cases. So that kind of advice has happened sporadically over the years. And in fairness, it has continued to happen sporadically. A lot of people think that the reason why Bill Clinton's two nominees sailed through relatively their own confirmation processes is because Bill Clinton spoke not only to Democratic senators but to Republican senators like Orrin Hatch too, and got assurances from them about Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So this advice function has been there.
My guest is David Yeloff, author of Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Yeloff, author of the book Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. We're looking at the history of Supreme Court confirmation hearings. When we left off, we were talking about the Senate's role of advice and consent. How much advice would you say President Bush, George W. Bush, has sought out from the Senate?
Well, from what we can tell, at least from the media reports and the accounts, he did seek out Senate advice, at least when Sandra Day O'Connor first announced her intention to retire, before choosing John Roberts to replace her, that he did actually go to senators and talk to them, senators from both sides of the aisle, and get their sense of who they might support or not support. And again, when after Chief Justice Rehnquist passed away and John Roberts became the nominee for Chief Justice, when he started looking for who might now replace Sandra Day O'Connor, again, he spoke to many of the senators. And we know that because Harry Reid, the Senate minority leader for the Democrats, very specifically admits that he liked Harriet Myers and told President Bush so. And a lot of people believe the reason President Bush initially chose Harriet Myers is because he felt with a Senate minority leader on his side, how could he lose? So we did see at least consultation for those first two choices. There is some complaint that Judge Alito was chosen very, very quickly without that kind of consultation. But, of course, his names had been on earlier lists.
Well, you know, you said with the Senate minority leader behind him, how could the president lose? And the way he lost with Harriet Myers was through Republicans, through conservatives in the Republican Party. And, you know, some people say Harriet Myers nomination was scuttled because she didn't have enough qualifications, but many people say it's because people on the right weren't confident enough that she would be far enough to the right in her decisions.
Well, I think both of those factors probably mattered. I think that many of the conservative Republicans, we heard from Sam Brownback and Tom Coburn, among others, were interested in opposing her from the standpoint of they weren't sure she was a true blue ideological conservative. But perhaps if her credentials had been impeccable and unimpeachable by any means, they would not have been able to get the traction they got against her. Because there were questions about her credentials, they were able to combine their own ideological objections with questions about her credentials, and the combination proved deadly. But I should tell you, Terry, a lot of people think that if President Bush had stayed behind Harriet Myers and not been willing to withdraw her and pushed it through the whole process, that he still would have gotten the 51 votes he needed, and that the Senate Democrats probably would not have filibustered. Of course, we'll never know, but it is interesting that even in this situation, we don't know for sure whether all of the Senate Republicans, or many of them even, were going to back down. And to be quite frank, I think President Bush's mistake with Harriet Myers, if it can be called a mistake, is that he took for granted that he would have all of the Senate Republicans' votes at a minimum. And it turns out that no longer could they have thought that that was in the bag once the Harriet Myers nomination proceeded.
How often has a nominee not even made it to the Judiciary Committee like Harriet Myers?
Quite often. We have seen nominees withdrawn before they actually get to a particular point to even get a up-down vote on the merits. We saw it. John Tyler in the early part of the 19th century saw two of his nominees, Edward King and John Reed, that their nominations were postponed. No action was taken. When presidents in particular have been weak, they often find it difficult not only to get their nominees confirmed, but sometimes to even get that infamous up-down vote. More recently, we saw Harriet Myers, but just in 1987, Douglas Ginsburg, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals judge that Ronald Reagan had nominated to replace Bork as a nominee, his name was again withdrawn before a final vote on the merits because of the allegations that he had smoked marijuana as a Harvard law professor. Not as a Harvard law student, but as a Harvard law professor. So we do very often see nominations withdrawn to avoid embarrassment and, more importantly, from the president's point of view, to get a better nominee up there in a hurry.
There are definitely hot-button issues now that both senators and the American public are measuring the nominees against. I'm wondering how is that a recent phenomenon, that there's something the equivalent of the abortion issue that Supreme Court nominees are measured against? Were there hot-button issues in earlier eras?
I mean, I think that there was a sense in general of ideology in earlier eras, but in the era we have now, with public hearings and public attention to Supreme Court nominations, I think it is unusual that there would be just one issue or a handful of issues that could galvanize entire nominations, that create this notion of litmus tests. I mean, I'm sure prior to the Civil War, the president's appointing justices were thinking about how might this person rule on issues having to do with slavery and property rights. And I'm sure the Senate, when they were rejecting or confirming those nominees, thought about that too. But now we're talking about very, very specific issues, the Establishment Clause, abortion, and the notion that we might actually confirm or reject a nominee on the basis of how they believe the court should rule on one or two issues, that is a relatively modern phenomenon.
And what about this? You know, in the process of the president presenting to the public his nominee and in the confirmation hearing process, there is often now an emphasis on the person's biography, how they rose to the prominent position that they're in. Certainly in the case of Clarence Thomas, like so much of the hearings were about, how he rose as an African-American man. And there's so much like biographically, and we look for this kind of like heroic story. And is that a relatively recent phenomenon?
It is, because when you're talking about biography, you're not really selling Supreme Court nominees to senators. I think there are very few senators who would be so touched by this, the biographical story of a nominee that might actually affect their confirmation. I think it's a great story, though, to sell to the public. And when you have a controversial nomination, if you can paint a Supreme Court nominee as kind of overcoming the odds, Clarence Thomas from the little town of Pinpoint, Georgia, that's a story that is works well with the public. We actually saw a little of that with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who did not come from impoverished circumstances or a small town, but did overcome discrimination against her when she first became a lawyer. And that was an important story, one that actually Bill Clinton liked a lot. So these kinds of biographical factors do come in, and they do matter.
David Yelov is the author of the 1999 book Pursuit of Justices. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. He'll be back in the second half of the show. By the way, I want to remind you that tomorrow our guest will be Bruce Springsteen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Did Joss on the city bed, scooter searching for his groove. Seemed like the whole world walking pretty.
Funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Stalking the Puzzle Lady, a puzzle lady mystery by Parnell Hall, available in hardcover. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas and Robert Bork affected subsequent confirmation hearings. We continue our conversation with David Yelov. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles Sandy Denny. She was part of the British folk rock scene in the 60s. She sang with Fairport Convention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In preparation for the confirmation hearings of Judge Samuel Alito, we're looking at the history of Supreme Court confirmation hearings. My guest is David Yelov, author of the book Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. How did the Clarence Thomas confirmation process and the Anita Hill hearings change what subsequently happened, change the future of the confirmation process?
Well, I think the Senate Judiciary Committee and specifically the senators on the Judiciary Committee were very bothered how it played out. I think they sensed that the whole process got away from them, and perhaps it did. It's very easy to forget that there were a whole set of hearings held on Clarence Thomas's nomination before Anita Hill's allegations about possible or alleged sexual harassment came to the forefront. And he was controversial on ideological grounds even before that happened. Many of the senators were already making judgments. Then, of course, the Anita Hill allegations were heard, and a whole new set of hearings took place, and the allegations and controversy that went back and forth. In most instances, it actually just galvanized opinion, but froze it where it had been already. Those who already were inclined to support his candidacy believed him, and those who already were inclined to oppose him believed her. In the end, you didn't get that many votes changed. But here's what you did get. A sense from the Senate Judiciary Committee that they were going to try not to let this ever happen again. And that is, they are willing to go now into closed session and hear very specific issues that might be a source of embarrassment or might be questionable. Not absolutely everything has to be aired publicly unless the Senate Judiciary Committee believes it's warranted. We haven't had an instance like that since then. But it is important to say that the Senate Judiciary Committee did not feel that that was its finest hour.
In 1987, President Reagan nominated Robert Bork for the Supreme Court. That nomination was rejected. And how did that rejection affect the politics surrounding Supreme Court nominees afterwards?
Oh, it affected it a great deal. In the case of Robert Bork, we had somebody who wasn't just a D.C. Court of Appeals judge for 4 or 5 years. We had somebody who had been a law professor and had written very controversial articles where he had literally targeted certain Warren Court precedents and other decisions as being illegitimate and poorly reasoned. And when he came before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1987, he didn't attempt in any way to back down from the harsh criticism he'd leveled at many of those decisions. He stood by them. He believed it was his role to educate the senators. And he thought of the Senate Judiciary Committee, some people joked at the time, as kind of one of his great law school classroom from Yale. The senators did not feel that way at all. They were very frustrated. And I think ultimately they determined that that Robert Bork might be rejected not so much because of his conservatism, although that was squarely there and in the minds of everybody, but also because that conservatism was accompanied by, in many of their minds, a closed mind. He wasn't open-minded about these things. And so since the Robert Bork hearings, what we've seen are presidents attempting to nominate individuals who are squarely compatible with them ideologically. So you have seen President George H.W. Bush appoint conservatives, and you have seen Bill Clinton appoint people who are more liberal. But at the same time, these are individuals who don't wear their ideologies on their sleeve. They haven't appeared to be crusading ideologues. And in some instances, they've been stealth nominees where it was impossible to even tell what their ideology was. Now, that worked with David Souter. It didn't work well with Harriet Myers. And so we may actually be seeing a new era here where the stealth nominee, the reaction to Bork, isn't going to work as well as it did in the case of David Souter.
Now, you're saying that in Bork's case he was rejected because the senators thought he had a closed mind.
Well, it was a combination.
You know, a lot of people felt that he was very ideologically driven. Was it unusual for a candidate to be rejected because of their ideology or a perception that they had a closed mind, as opposed to the fact that they just didn't have the credentials for the job?
Not at all. I mean, I think to some extent ideology has driven a lot of the rejection of Supreme Court nominees over the years. And this was a subject actually of a great debate between Lawrence Tribe, who wrote a book called God Save This Honorable Court, and David Donelsky and other scholars who kind of challenged some of what Lawrence Tribe argued in that particular book. We have seen ideology come into play in the decision to reject and accept. I think, though, when you really want to take on a nominee on the basis of his or her ideology, and that is the only means by which you have to take that on, And if you're facing a president who's relatively strong, maybe he has the Senate on his side, he has his party controls the Senate. When all of those factors are facing you, it is important to actually try to accompany the complaints about ideology with something else. And I think some of the senators in Bork's case were able to combine their complaints about his ideology with complaints about this quote-unquote closed mind.
My guest is David Yelov, author of Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Yelov, and he's an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. For this book, you read a lot of presidential papers and looking for their descriptions of how they went about selecting their nominees. Given what you know historically about how presidents have gone about that process, where do you think President Bush fits in? I know you haven't been able to read his papers, but
no, not for a while. I don't think I'll be able to see that.
A long while. But based on what you've seen, where would you say he fits in his approach to choosing nominees?
Well, I think in some ways we already get the sense that President George W. Bush has borrowed from the playbook of Ronald Reagan. Certainly in the selection of lower court nominees, but potentially in the selection of Supreme Court nominees as well. What Ronald Reagan did was introduce to the process a willingness to invest considerable resources to research candidates, to examine their opinions, to examine all their opinions, their law reviews, their writings, to have a team of lawyers, whether it's in the Justice Department, the White House, or both, going over all of these opinions to try to get a sense of how this individual sees the law, views issues, and how this person might, frankly, rule once they got on the United States Supreme Court. That kind of scouring of research wasn't possible in the case of Harriet Myers because she'd never been a judge. But in the case of John Roberts, who had been a judge and had been a lawyer in the executive branch, and especially in the case of Judge Alito, where you have 15 years of opinions to go over, I think that kind of exhaustive research, which Ronald Reagan introduced, is probably the approach that George W. Bush has taken as well. No surprises, at least from the administration's viewpoint. We want to know everything we can about the nomination. And I think to some extent that is a contrast from previous presidents who very often didn't even try to determine what the individual might do on the court. Chose individuals because they were friends or friends of friends or because they knew them to be a great lawyer and trusted them. That kind of more minimal review of a candidate's credentials, I think that that's part of a time past. And I think President Bush's approach is probably going to be copied by future administrations as well.
Does this say something about how much more important the Supreme Court is seen as being now?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. It does say that the Supreme Court, in a way that possibly we've only seen sporadically in past eras of American history, but now it almost seems continuous, the Supreme Court has inserted itself, for better or worse, in many of the largest issues and the most controversial issues of the day, whether it's abortion or school prayer or federalism. These are issues that aren't going away, and the Supreme Court is part of that decision-making process. I think the way it used to be is there would be moments, there would be eras where the Supreme Court would insert itself. Very famously in the 1930s, when the Supreme Court was striking down aspects of the New Deal as unconstitutional, they certainly were part of the American debate and dialogue at a very high level then. But then they kind of receded back in away from the limelight for at least a few decades. What the Warren Court did was they brought the Supreme Court squarely into what David O'Brien has called the storm center of American politics. And that's the way it continues to be. And I think that's the way it's going to be for a while now. And so from that standpoint, yes, I think that it's hard to imagine the Supreme Court nominees and their hearings not continuing to get this high level of attention.
One of the reasons why everybody feels there's so much at stake in Supreme Court nominees is that the nominees, when they become justices, are appointed for life. And the younger the justice is, the longer that life term becomes. Why are Supreme Court justices appointed for life? I understand why they're appointed and why they're not voted, because you don't want their votes to be popularity contests. But why for life? Why was it agreed for life as opposed to a 10-year term or a 15-year term?
Well, Article 3, Section 1 says that the judges of both the Supreme and inferior courts are supposed to hold their offices during good behavior. So I think really the nature of your question is not so much why is that the way it is now, but why did the founding fathers, why did the framers of the Constitution put that in? And I think when you read some of the Federalist Papers, particularly those written by Alexander Hamilton, you do get a sense of the importance of an independent judiciary, willing to make decisions separate from considerations of how it might affect politics, how it might improve the situation within the executive branch or within the legislative branch. I should, however, provide an important qualification here, and that is the framers and writers of the Constitution, in particular Alexander Hamilton, never imagined that the court would play this significant a role in American politics. In fact, Alexander Hamilton referred to the Supreme Court as being the least dangerous branch, and many people would tell you that is no longer the case.
As someone who has studied the Supreme Court justice selection process, what are some of the things you are looking for now as this current drama unfolds, Judge Alito confirmation process?
Well, everybody is, I think, interested in how the Senate Democrats are going to proceed in asking questions and then considering the ultimate strategy on their part, which is the filibuster. You've already mentioned Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas was only confirmed 52-48. So in theory, if the Democrats had wanted to filibuster that particular nomination, they could have done it easily because there were not 60 votes to confirm him. And so whether they will actually consider utilizing the filibuster against Judge Alito, that's something that everybody is certainly watching. And more importantly, on what basis will they, if they do try the filibuster, what basis will they use to justify it? Will it be strictly on ideology? We have a president here, President George W. Bush, who campaigned promising that he would appoint conservative justices in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. And so theoretically, if he does so, he's fulfilling a campaign promise. Can the Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats stand in that way? Will they stand in that way? Will they keep their ranks together? And then, of course, we see the Republicans as well. There have been several senators on the Republican side, Chafee from Rhode Island and both of the senators from Maine have on occasion, rarely but on occasion, voted against President Bush's nominees to the lower courts. Can they be picked off? And these kinds of dynamics we're going to see as the Judge Alito nomination proceeds forward.
If the Democrats filibuster Judge Alito, thinking that he was too conservative, and if that filibuster held, do you think that the next nominee chosen by President Bush would likely be more conservative?
Well, that is what history tells us. History tells us that when a nominee is defeated by the opposition, and Richard Nixon faced that when Clement Haynsworth was defeated primarily by Democrats from the North and the West. Certainly, President Reagan faced that when Robert Bork was defeated, largely at the hands of Democrats. When that has happened in the past, they have reacted, at least initially, by nominating somebody who may be even more objectionable to the opposition. We don't want to reward the opposition. And so we saw that in the case of Nixon. He appointed G. Harold Carswell, who was even more conservative than Clemens Haynsworth. And we frankly saw that, at least initially, with Ronald Reagan. He appointed Doug Ginsburg from the D.C. Circuit, who was considered quite conservative as well. Both of those instances, though, do provide a caution, however, Terry, because neither of those two replacements were confirmed as well. So if the Democrats have the power to filibuster the first one on conservative grounds, then a more conservative nominee might end up with the same fate. And then you have a lot of interesting questions, because we have the 2006 midterm elections coming up. This issue might spill into that. How it would affect that is impossible to tell. And President Bush would have to, at that point, make some very difficult political judgments about how far he can continue to push this. But I think there is something, though, in the fact that Democrats know they had better take something that they can palpably defend to their constituents, because this president is probably never going to appoint a liberal or somebody that they would, in theory, like.
So when judiciary hearings are in process and they're questioning a Supreme Court nominee, do you stop everything else you're doing and just watch? Like, do you still go to class and teach, or do you just, like, watch?
I do have to go to class and teach, but I will confess, Terry, that sometimes I actually show the hearings during class so that I don't have to miss parts of them. I find that my students are enthralled. If I can pick particular parts of the hearings, there's some wonderful dialogue between Senator Joe Biden and John Roberts that just – it gives so much interesting information about the nature of the Supreme Court and how these confirmation hearings fit in. I love to show that to students, not only to students. I went up to Dartmouth College and spoke to a group of senior citizens up there as part of their continuing education program. And I showed them hearings. They wanted to see more. So I am one of those sickos, Terry. I can sit there and watch C-SPAN. My family does not like me on that Saturday after the hearings, because I will sit there and watch a replay of the hearings. I am not well on these issues, I do confess. I do think it's drama, and it's real drama. But you know what the best part is? This is one of those few moments in American politics where all three branches meet. We have a president's nominee being judged by the legislature, and it's going to have a direct impact on the judiciary. You rarely get all three branches kind of jammed together into one room with so much at stake. And that's why, as a student of American politics, I find it impossible to look away.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry.
David Yelov is the author of Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics, and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Sandy Denny and considers her role in the British folk rock scene of the 60s. This is Fresh Air. Like the Americans, the British had a folk rock revolution in the 60s, and perhaps its signature voice was a young woman named Sandy Denny, whose short career was filled with ups and downs. Rock historian Ed Ward has her story.
How often she has gazed from castle windows all and watched the daylight passing within her captive wall with no one.
Alexandra Elaine McLean Denny was a nurse and art student when she began going to folk clubs in the mid-60s. Her voice attracted the attention of a small folk label, which paid her a pittance to record versions of standard folk songs, and she found herself bitten by the showbiz bug. She began writing songs and hanging out with three musicians from London's Strawberry Hill district, the Strawberry Hill Boys, with whom she recorded an album in 1968. By the time it was released, though, the band was known as the Straubs, and she'd been tapped to replace the female singer in one of Britain's top up-and-coming bands, Fairport Convention. At first, Fairport wasn't sure what they wanted to be exactly. They took after the West Coast folk rock groups in America, recording Bob Dylan songs as well as songs by their brilliant guitarist, Richard Thompson. On their second album with Sandy Denny, they recorded a song of hers she'd done with the Straubs.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving, but how can they know it's time for them to go?
Who Knows Where the Time Goes brought Sandy Denny to fame. Others, most notably Judy Collins, have attempted the song, but nobody's even come close to the original. Perhaps realizing that they'd gone as far as they could in this direction, Fairport turned towards traditional British folk music on their next album, Liege and Leaf, a move no less controversial among British folkies than Bob Dylan's Going Electric was to American ones. It even got airplay in America, where Tam Lin, A Tale of Death and Enchantment, was an FM radio standby. What Liege and Leaf showed was that Sandy Denny was more than capable of fronting an electric band, but her own preferences seemed to be elsewhere. She'd taken up with a guitarist named Trevor Lucas, and as Fairport began internal squabbling, in 1970, she formed a band called Fotheringay with Lucas to showcase her own material.
My friend, I know you've suffered, although you are still young. Why was it you would not take help from anyone? Oh, it's true, it's very true, he said. Some hard times I have known, but I
Fotheringay lasted less than a year, long enough for Sandy to be awarded Best Female Vocalist in Melody Maker's year-end poll, but by the time she picked up the honor, she'd already broken the band up, and her next appearance was on Led Zeppelin IV's Song of Evermore. The next 6 years would see her recording four more albums of her own songs, which were increasingly obscure and mostly played at a dirge tempo. She became thought of as a cult artist, which apparently bothered her enough that, along with her now husband Trevor Lucas, she rejoined Fairport in 1974, only to see the band fall apart again the next year. In 1976, she went into the studio with a full album's worth of songs, mostly based around the theme of a rocky marriage. Using a full orchestra, Steve Winwood, and a number of ex-Fairporters, she knocked out the album in record time.
Where you may stand in your splendor.
Unfortunately, Lucas, who was producing, decided the album should have some more mainstream material and had to record, among other things, Elton John's Candle in the Wind. The delay in getting the record out, compounded by the birth of her daughter in July 1977, meant that the tour to promote it had to wait until late fall. The record flopped. The marriage was strained. In April 1978, Sandy was staying with a friend who came home on the 17th to find her in a coma, having fallen down a flight of stairs. She never woke up, and a great voice was silenced.
Farewell, farewell to you who dear, you lonely travelers all. The cold north wind will blow again. The winding road does call.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Joan Tuohy-Westman, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, working to create valuable and sustainable buildings and communities. Good design makes a difference. At AIA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bruce Springsteen. He has a new Born to Run box set. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.